God promised would come. We'll start here.
A king from the line of David.
A king from the line of David, 2 Samuel 7.
Priest after the order of Melchizedek.
A priest after the order of Melchizedek in Psalm 110, yes.
Serpent crusher.
A serpent crusher from Genesis 3, where he makes that promise to the Eve.
A suffering servant.
Suffering servant from Isaiah 42 and following. A conqueror, yes, he's going to conquer, isn't he? So Psalm 2 would be a good example of that.
One like the Son of Man.
One like the Son of Man from Daniel 7.
Prince of Peace from Isaiah 9.
Prince of Peace from Isaiah 9.
Son of David. Oh, wait, we've already said that. The Moses figure in Deuteronomy 18.
The Moses figure, yes.
Elijah in Malachi 4.
Elijah in Malachi 4. Getting harder over here now, isn't it? Yes.
The virgin birth in Isaiah 7.
Isaiah 7, the son of a virgin.
He promised Noah and us that he wouldn't flood the world again. What?
He promised not another Noah, but he promised that he wouldn't flood the world with the water again. Yes. It's getting harder. Yes, he'll be my son. Yes, so it is the son of David, but his son, yes?
Anointed one.
Anointed one, yes, the Christ. Any others we've got going?
We've run out.
You've run out. We've run out. And you've got any others somewhere or other?
Genesis
47, yes, he'll be of the tribe of Judah, yes?
He'll be a shepherd.
He'll be a shepherd, yes. Where?
Psalm 23.
Psalm 23 says he is, but I think if we go for Ezekiel, Zechariah 12 and Ezekiel 37 would do that, yes? Sorry?
Numbers 24 about the star from Jacob.
Numbers 24 about the...
It says something about a star will come out of Jacob.
A star will come out of Jacob, okay?
The son of righteousness, Malachi 4.
Son of righteousness in Malachi 4. We haven't said Emmanuel. Would you like to say Emmanuel? Right, thank you very much for that motion.
Seven.
All those in favour? No.
Offspring of Abraham in Genesis 12.
No, Genesis 12, we've left that out, which is one of the most important ones. It'll be the offspring of Abram. A lot of the other promises come out of that promise.
Also in Zechariah, a king on a donkey.
A king on a donkey, yes, in Zechariah 9:9.
We also have this God is coming.
God is coming from Isaiah 40. Son of David, we have done, yes.
Rock in Daniel 2.
A rock.
Lots of nature. We had a branch in Jeremiah 33 as well.
A branch, a rock. Well, God is the rock. I don't remember that being promised, but that doesn't mean it's not there. It just
Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar's dream.
Yes.
Different materials, the rock come and smash it, will live forever.
The rock will come and establish it. And, yes.
This might be a stretch, Jacob's dream.
Yes.
Seeing the kingdom of God at the gate, Jesus the gate.
Well, John chapter 2 picks up the dream of Isaiah, of Jacob, yes. There's lots, isn't there? No? The whole Old Testament, but it's not just one stream. There's all these different streams pointing to this character who is to come. And they're the promises of God that they're going to come. I want to pick up on a couple of them that are pretty important that you need to be aware of. Genesis 12, I said. A lot of them come out of the Genesis 12. See, Genesis 1 to 11 sets the scene for the whole Bible. Genesis 1 to 11 is about humanity. Then Genesis 12 focuses in on one family. The end of Genesis 11 focuses in on that family. And one person in particular, Abram. And then to Abram is promised in 12 verses 1 to 3. I've got a really bad cold coming on and terrible throat, so it'd be very helpful if people could read for me rather than me reading constantly. So if someone can read 12, 1 to 3 in a good loud voice, please. Thank you for your help. That's really good. In other words, no one has yet. Thank you. Good on you, Emily. Yes. Those three promises to Abram form the basis of, in one sense, the rest of the Bible, but especially the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. Three things. They're going to give a land, they're going to be a great people, and through him all the other nations will be blessed and cursed. And when you read through the rest of the book of Genesis, that's what happens with Abram. One thing after another after another. That frames what the rest of the events are about. But that just sets the scene for the rest of the Bible. And the children of Abraham, Jacob, Isaac, and then Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel. And so you get the 12 children of Israel, or the 12 tribes, and all coming out of Abram and this promise that is not only given to him, but it's repeated to Isaac, and it's repeated to Jacob as well. Here is the basic promise that God makes to the nations. But pick the Moses one, for example. Where was that? Deuteronomy, someone said. Deuteronomy 18. If you could read verses 15 to Deuteronomy 15. Was it Deuteronomy 18, 15 to 19? Deuteronomy. Okay, so another prophet's coming, like Moses. Moses is the greatest prophet in the Old Testament, but another one's coming. And you really must listen to this one that's coming. Well, every time a prophet comes, people now think, is this the Moses? Is this the Moses? Because we're looking for the prophet that we must pay careful attention to, because he's going to be the new Moses. So each of these references that you've given to us, they all are ways of thinking about someone coming. But of course, being promises of God, they are fulfilled, though they take a long time, over 1,000 years. David, it's easy to remember the Bible chronology. David lived 1000 BC. You were born or live around 2000 AD. So it's very simple kind of understanding of chronology. Abraham's a long time before David, so he's more than 1000 years before Christ. Promises are made. And it takes a long time for the promises to come true. But being God, he's not a politician. They come true. One of those famous promises made in Australian politics was made by Bob Hawke in 1987 when he was seeking re-election. And at Sydney Opera House, here is this little snippet of his speech. I hope it's loud enough for us to hear, will it be? If not, tough. The first person you look at is not Bob Hawke, but he'll disappear in 2 seconds. Are you ready?
By 1990, no Australian child will be living in poverty.
Now, amongst the promises anybody could make, that's about as stupid as they go, isn't it? And as you can see, seeing you've lived beyond the year 1990, in fact, some of you don't remember 1990s at all, do you? The idea that all children would be out of poverty, it's just not true. But the promises of man keep failing. That's the character of it. Either because we're liars, I'm not saying he was, but either we're liars, or because we're impotent, we can't actually do what we promise. But God is not a liar, and he's not impotent. But he works at his timetable, not ours. A day is as 1,000 years to the Lord, and 1,000 years is as a day. And so he slowly and steadily brings his promises into effect. And the rest of the Bible is about God's faithfulness to his promises and the importance of God's people having faith in God's promises. That is, Christian thinking, biblical thinking, is not experientialism. It's not feeling God's presence. It's not being in the presence of God. You may feel God's presence, you may be in the presence of God, but that's not what it's about. It's about living by what you've been promised. God promises this, and the basis of his promises, I have faith. That's what we mean by faith. Trusting the person who makes the promises, trusting the promises that are made. And so we're standing on the promises of God. That's the carry. That's why the Word of God is so important. Because we are so Christianized, we don't necessarily understand how extraordinary this is. None of the ancient Greek, Egyptian, Roman gods, Canaanite gods, ever kept promises. They rarely made them, and if they did make them, they were like Bob Hawke. Either they couldn't keep them or they wouldn't keep them. And you're a fool to believe them. It wasn't about promises. It was about manipulating the gods to give you what you want right now. It was about the prosperity gospel. So when people have a prosperity gospel today, you know they're not Christian. Well, they might be Christian, but they're Christianly totally confused. Because it's not about prosperity in the here and now. That's not what it's about. That's ancient Canaanite religion. That's Greek. No, no. It's about keeping trust in God's trustworthiness. That he's made promises and he'll keep his promises. Well, tonight's prayer time, slightly different. Next week, Moore College goes on its annual mission to all kinds of places. Hands up any of you are in a church where a mission is going to that you know about. This mission team coming to your church. Either your minister hasn't told you, if that's the case, or you haven't been listening lately, and if that's the case, worse still, or they're not going to your church, they're going to other churches. So I thought we should be praying, especially for our college team and for your church, if they're coming to your church, but seeing no one knows where they're coming. So, sorry?
They're
going to
tell us, right?
They're going to tell us. So, quickly pop up, each one of you, and tell me which one of you two is going to pop up. You can't pop up quickly ever, can you now?
I'll be on the
fastest. Yeah. Watch out, I'm sorry. So, where are you going to?
Cassie and I are going to Wurrunga. I always like trying to say it.
Wurrunga.
Anyone up at Wurrunga?
If you head towards Queensland, just before you get there, stop.
Okay.
You're there, in Wurrunga.
Just before, right. Yeah.
Okay, what are you going to do in Wurrunga?
There's so much happening, so many things to get involved in.
Hang on. Who's going to lead in prayer for Percy and Sophie? No point telling you the prayer points if they're not going to hop and pray for you in a second. Hands up those who, it's all right. It's okay, you're allowed. Hands up those who really know nothing about Bob Hawke. His picture is there. Good, okay. Bob Hawke was one of the finest Australian prime ministers we've had in the 1980s. Sorry, he was one of the finest prime ministers we had. He was prime minister in the 1980s. That's a bit better, it's not only in the 1980s. He was a very popular man, extraordinarily popular man, who was a Rhodes Scholar from Perth, and he was in the Guinness Book of Records, amongst other things. He was a cricketer, and he was elected as Prime Minister several times, which is unusual. We like to turn over our Prime Ministers as often as possible. He actually won several elections, including that one where he made that silly promise. He only died a couple of years ago, and it was the who's who of Australia went to the state funeral in at the Opera House and spoke of the greatness of this man. Bob Hawke's grandfather was an evangelical minister, Congregationalist, a fierce anti-alcohol man. As evangelicals were terribly opposed to the use of alcohol because of the terrible rotting it does to poor people, and we're concerned about poor people. And the impoverished communities are the ones who most suffer from alcohol abuse and gambling abuse. And his concern as a Congregationalist minister was such that he was a teetotaler who argued we should get rid of alcohol altogether. Bob Hawke's father was also a Congregationalist minister, moved to South Australia and elsewhere, But he wasn't so teetotal and he wasn't so evangelical. He was more liberal theologically. Bob was a first-class cricketer, got first-class honours in his degrees, and so got selected to be a Rhodes Scholar. But by the time he reached Oxford, he had given up Christianity. He says he gave up Christianity because he went to India and he saw how rich the Christians were and how poor other people were. And it went against his kind of working class value system taught to him by his parents and his grandparents, that it should be so. That, of course, is not the real story. The real story is that in those days you had to be a bachelor to win a Rhodes Scholarship, and he had a girlfriend and he'd already got her pregnant, and so he persuaded her to have an abortion, though it was totally illegal in those days, of course, to have an abortion so that he could remain single so that he could take up his scholarship. He's a man, you see, he'd already moved away from the gospel considerably, as well as intergenerationally, as his grandfather's clear belief in the gospel was watered down in his father and was renounced by Bob. He never became an atheist, he was an agnostic, but he became an alcoholic. And so he's in the Guinness Book of Records for drinking the largest amount of beer in the shortest possible time. That was his great claim to fame. But he became a terrible alcoholic and in many ways an abuser of the woman who stayed and did marry him later, even though later on in life he dumped her and ran off with another woman because he became a serial adulterer all through his adult life, and finally left her for another younger model of her. And so he's a degenerate. He was a very great prime minister, but he was a terribly degenerate man. Our society loved him. Beer drinking womanizer, fitted in with the Australian culture. Very clever, very able, brought about all kinds of very impressive changes to our society. But he was a terrible man in how he lived. And his children were atheists. In fact, one of them became a drug addict and was raped by one of his offsiders, but he told her to be quiet about it because he didn't want to lose the election, which might have happened had it been known that this was happening within. See, the story of Bob Hulk is hard to tell. When he's alive, it's easier to tell now that he's dead. The story is, although documented, I'm not saying anything that's private, I've got no secret knowledge, I'm just telling you the public knowledge, really, of what this man was like. Very important to understand trajectories, though, isn't it? The trajectory was always moving away from the clear gospel through one generation of liberal Christianity to the next generation of agnosticism to the next generation of atheism. It's a very sad trajectory. But you need to understand the trajectory you're in, the trajectory your family's in, and so we'll come to that with August when we go away to look at the trajectory. I can never think of Bobby Hawke and the stupid promises he made on this occasion. The greatness of a man who really was just so awful as a man. He really was dreadful. He used and abused women. He used and abused alcohol. He used and abused people to get ahead of where he wanted to get to. But he ran the country. And in running the country, he brought us great prosperity and justice. Life is very complicated, isn't it? But the Bible makes it clear. It's called sin. So, we'll hear some other advertisements now from other people. Here we go. Tony's going to tell us. What are you going to tell us about, Tony? And then we'll have a break, that right? Okay, we'll start up the back this time, not to leave people out. Here we go. Who knew?
Mary.
Mary did, yes.
Simeon
did, yes. Mind you, Mary thought he was mad and went to take him away later, didn't she? So maybe she didn't. Simeon was an old man when Jesus was a baby, so he was dead.
The wise men.
the wise men, whoever they were, but they were not, yes, wise, and they'd gone back home.
The woman at the well.
The woman at the well knew who he was. That's a good one, isn't it? Of course, she was a Samaritan, so she wasn't amongst the Jews.
Anna the prophetess,
who was 84 years old when she saw him as a baby, so she was dead. Mm.
The demons
did, yes. The demons keep on seeing who he was, but he keeps telling them to shut up about it, doesn't he? Yeah.
Paralyzed man.
Which paralyzed man?
The one that went through the roof.
The one who went through the roof. Did he know he was the Christ? He knew his sins were forgiven because of him, but I don't know whether he knew he was the Christ.
We had twice our people said. We had Mary and Joseph and Simeon and his wife.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Peter knew, otherwise he wouldn't have said it.
Peter knew before Peter knew, otherwise he wouldn't have said it. Yeah, okay.
Peter's profession.
Mm. Before Peter's profession. You mean you've never spoken before you've thought?
Yeah, I always think before.
You always think before. I want people to know. Andrew Barrage always thinks before he talks. Hands up those who believe that. There you go. Okay. Good.
Have we said John the Baptist?
You have not said John the Baptist, but if you did say John the Baptist, I'd say, but he wasn't too sure because chapter 12 he asked to find out.
Yeah, we got. I was going to say Satan.
Satan. Yes, Satan.
I literally said.
Might have known, yes?
His father.
His father in heaven. Yeah, there's a good chance his father in heaven knew, yes. Thank you. Yes. Over here.
Gabriel the angel.
Gabriel the angel. Yeah, that's a good one, isn't it? Yes. All right.
Jesus.
Jesus knew, yes.
King Herod.
King Herod knew, but he was dead.
But he knew before he died.
Yeah, he did know before he died, which was before Peter made the confession. That's correct. I mean, lots of them that we've mentioned here did know before the prophet, but most of them had died, or several of them had died. And Mary and John the Baptist were a bit uncertain because what Jesus did didn't quite fit into what was expected. Sorry, who did I say? John the Baptist.
John died.
And John's dead before Peter professes. That's true too. But he'd been reassured by then. And it's interesting, isn't it? And the demons, you see, they know. But come back to, pick it up where? Mark 1. Mark 1, there's a demon there, isn't it? Verse 23, and immediately there was in the synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying with a loud voice, came out of him. And you get the same kind of pattern several times, don't you? Go across to chapter 3, verse 11. Where's 3:11? And whenever the unclean spirit saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." And he strictly ordered them not to make him known. That is, there is an intentionality of Jesus to say secret about his identity. He keeps on saying, "Don't tell, don't tell." And not many people know. We know because we're reading it and watching it. He's doing the things that give away that he's the Christ, but he's not actually being identified. He's talking in parables about the kingdom of God that the Christ comes to bring, but as we saw last week, he talks in parables so that they wouldn't understand. He does miracles that demonstrate he's the Moses, feeding the multitude in the wilderness, walking across the sea, but yet they don't understand. They can't seem to grasp what is taking place. And the ones who do know, the demons, he keeps shutting up. We don't know why, in one sense. It may be that he doesn't want to be his testimony come from the sources of evil. Maybe he's just in control of the information. Because when Peter tells him, we're back in chapter 8 when Peter says it, Jesus agrees and he strictly charged them, verse 30, to tell no one about him. Here is a man who's come into the world to be the Christ, King, ruler of the universe, and the one thing he keeps on saying is, "Don't tell anybody. Keep it quiet." He knew, we know he knew, because of the baptism. when the voice came from heaven. So we know he knew, but he didn't want anybody else to know, which is a strange thing to do if you actually want to come and rule the world. Most of our politicians are telling us who they are all the time. I mean, at the moment, drive around Sydney and there are all these ugly pictures everywhere of people who would claim to rule us if we just gave them half a chance. But not Jesus. In fact, if you go across to John, I don't want us to use John much because that's the third term, but in John chapter 7, his brothers say something which is just so human. John 7, verse 21. Yeah, well, have I got the wrong chapter? Yes, I have. John 7 is not verse 21 then. Verse 3, that sounds good. Can someone read for us verses 3 to 7, please? Yeah, verse 3 to 8. Verse 3 to 9 will do us. Yes. John 7, 3 to 9. Come on.
His brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it, that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I'm not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." After saying this, he remained in Galilee.
See, if you're going to do the things you're going to do them publicly. Yeah, but Jesus said, "No, that's not how I'm going to do it. I'm doing it secretly." It's a kind of strange thing to be doing it secretly. And in fact, where he went before his Peter identified him was with his disciples up into Caesarea Philippi, that is outside of Israel. He goes up into the non-Jewish parts of Palestine, and just with his disciples, he asks this question, and they finally identify him. As soon as they identify him, well, he says, "Don't tell anybody about it," because that's not what he wants to be known by anybody. Why is making that dreadful noise? So, with Peter's confession then, he says, "You're the Christ." If you go to Matthew's Gospel, "You're the Son of the living God," because the Christ is to be the Son of God. But what Jesus then says is about the Son of Man. Then he began to teach them the Son of Man. Nobody calls Jesus Son of Man, but Jesus calls himself Son of Man more often than any other title. Jesus' title about himself is Son of Man, nobody else's. The phrase can mean three different things. It can mean human, not hard to work out, Son of Man, human. It can be an Aramaic one. It can be an Aramaic way of talking about oneself. Third person, impersonal, for those of you who are educated enough to understand anything about grammar. One can talk about oneself if one wants to. One sounds a little strange if one does. One sounds as if one should own corgis or something or other and live in a palace to speak of oneself like that. It's you know who's being referred to. It's a way of talking about the self, but it just is not everybody's kind of pattern of speech. The third reference is Daniel 7, which somebody picked up for us. So why don't we just go quickly there to Daniel 7. Daniel 7. Got to find it, that's one of the problems. It's shortly after Ezekiel, isn't it? And if we can read, please, 9 to 14. One such person in loud voice, one, chapter 7, verses 9 to 14. Someone has an ear. Yes, go for it, Tony, thank you.
"As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. Extreme of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked at them because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed.
It's a weird reference, but then this part of the book of Daniel always feels a little bit weird with beasts and all kinds of things happening. But here's the judgment at the end of the world. The Ancient of Days has in front of him all the books. They're all opened up. The evil ones are all destroyed. And then suddenly, instead of the judge of all the world saying something and doing something, suddenly this anonymous Son of Man comes in the clouds to heaven, goes upwards, not downwards. Most of our hymns and songs are about him coming downwards, where it's actually going upwards. He goes up to the Son of Man, up to the Ancient of Days, and the Ancient of Days gives him all authority to rule over all nations and all kingdoms for all time. And then he disappears. Now, when Jesus says, well, you know, the Son of Man, most people think he's talking about himself. Of course he was. But most people would have thought he was talking about himself as a man. And he was. But was he talking about Daniel 7? Yes, he was. But they didn't tweak to it. Because Daniel 7 is such a strange thing. And because a bloke who walks around saying, all the kingdoms of the world are going to be given to me and everyone forever and ever, is a strange person. Put it mildly. And that's, of course, he is the Son of Man. From there on in, the identification of Jesus is known to the disciples and not to the crowds. But the crowds are worried about, well, who is he? And so they keep on fighting with him about it. Well, the disciples have it reinforced because the next little section is the Transfiguration in chapter 9 of Mark's Gospel. Then he arrives in Jerusalem. And he's purposely arrives into Jerusalem. By the way, there's a lovely photos here, not of Jesus arriving, but there are lovely photos here of arriving in Jerusalem as a conqueror of Jerusalem. Jesus purposely chose not to walk in. Jesus actually chose to come on a little donkey because Zechariah 9 said, that's how the Messiah is going to come. And so he comes like it. But here are two pictures. The one on the left, it's a picture of a man walking to Jerusalem. The one on the right is a picture of a man riding a white horse coming in. The man on the right is Kaiser Wilhelm II in 1898 entering Jerusalem in front of an army sitting on a great white horse. The man on the left is General Allenby, who had just conquered Jerusalem. First time a Christian had conquered the Jerusalem since the time of the Crusades. And he purposely and intentionally got off his horse and walked in because he wasn't coming as the conqueror, he wasn't coming as the Christ. And so he very intentionally and surprisingly walked in to Jerusalem in order to bring peace amongst the different peoples of Jerusalem. Very striking thing happened in 1917, and in case you know, and in case you don't know, I wasn't alive. These are, you know, this is before my time, but it's a piece of history that was important thing to understand, that when he came in not as the Christ. When Muhammad came into Mecca, he came with an army of 10,000 soldiers, and Mecca conceded to him without a fight. When Jesus came to Jerusalem, he came on a donkey, and not even a full-grown one, the foal, the colt of a donkey, because he came as the Zechariah fulfillment. See, if you're going to understand Jesus, you've got to have the context of the Old Testament and use your cross-references to find out about it. General Allenby knew his Bible well enough to know not to come in as a conquering king. It would be totally inappropriate for a man to do that. Once in Jerusalem, Jesus then fights with the leaders. He cleanses the temple and they say, what authority have you got to do that? They argue, why are we paying taxes to Caesar? And he argues with that. The Sadducees come and say, well, what's this resurrection you're talking about? And he answers them. They say, which is the great commandment? They're testing him to find out who he is. All through those chapters, we'll look at those in subsequent days because that's the second half of the book. But they haven't identified Jesus. The disciples now know, and so in that second half of Mark's gospel, he's teaching them about what it means to be the suffering servant over and over again. He keeps predicting his death to them over and again. But that's privately he's teaching his disciples that. Publicly, he's in confrontation with the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the priests, the scribes. And the question, which is not the question, the elephant in the room really is, who is this man? Who is he? How does he fit into any prophecy? Is he genuine? Is he a... It comes to a climax at chapter 14 of Mark's Gospel. Mark 14. Someone read for us, please, verses 61 to 63. Mark 14, 61 to 63. How are we going? Good on you. Thank you.
But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming into the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his garments and said, what further witness do we need?
You see, he does identify himself as the Christ, but he immediately redefines Christ as the Son of Man. And this time, explicitly, the Son of Man of Daniel 7. I am the Christ who comes to be given in the judgment day the rule over all kingdoms for all times forever. I am to be the King of kings and Lord of lords. And so when he was crucified in chapter 15, the next chapter, verse 26, and the inscription of the charge against him read, the King of the Jews. So Jesus is killed as the Christ, as the Son of Man, as the King of Kings and Jews. Which is why the unusual healing of back in chapter Mark 8. What was the unusual healing? Because it comes immediately before Peter's understanding of Jesus being the Christ. And so our last reference tonight, Percy's going to read for us, are you? Verses 31 to 33. He's just said, you are the Christ. Jesus says, don't tell anybody. And then Jesus says,
and he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man.
Here was the great turning point of the Gospel of Mark. It's reflected in Matthew 16. It's also in Luke, but it's clearest in Mark and Matthew 16. It's the two sights. When finally sees, he doesn't see what he sees. And so he has to be healed a second time to understand what he's seeing. And Peter finally sees, you are the Christ. He doesn't understand what the Christ has come to do. And so he needs a second miracle. The first miracle, he saw that Jesus was the Christ. The second miracle, he saw that the Christ came to suffer for the sins of the world. And so why have we got this funny little miracle of the man being healed just before the point? It's so that you'll understand what's about. It did happen. But there were miracles and miracles and miracles Jesus did. Only some are selected. And they're positioned in their place in the gospel accounts so that you will get the point. The point is, Jesus keeps it secret. What? Who he is and why he's come. And what the gospel shows you is who he is and why he came, but it really shows you how they came to understand who he is and how they came to understand why he came. But you have to have both those things together. Next term, we're going to be really looking at why he came. This term, we've been looking at who he is and how he showed himself in such a way that they couldn't understand. But it was there for those who got eyes to see, those who got ears to hear. Next week, we're going to be looking more at the conquest of who he is.